The need is great. Already it may be too late. If there were another way or a lesser cost, I would not insist. But the choice is mine, and I say we must go to Dekra.
The voice was Derwin's, and from what Quentin could tell, the discussion, which had started again as soon as the breakfast table had been cleared, was a continuation of the one he had interrupted earlier. Quentin lazed in a patch of warm sunlight, half awake, sitting on the floor under a thick-glazed window, which the low winter sun filled with streaming yellow light. Quentin basked in the light and let the warmth seep into his bones.
No, we will find another way. We have time yet, and we know not what Jaspin plans.
Precisely. We know not what Jaspin plans, but it is certain to be nasty and cruel. Most likely his malice is already afoot. But what of that? He only wants a crown. Nimrod will not be so easily satisfied. He wants the world. We must go to Dekra.
Who or what Dekra was, Quentin did not know. But the conversation had been going on so long he had lost interest in it, and had retreated into the background to doze. The queen still sat at the table with the two men, but it had been a long time since she had occasion to speak. Quentin knew that nothing would be settled until this impasse between the two men was resolved. Presently he stood up and wrapped his cloak around him and slipped outside. The cold air tingled in his lungs, and the piercing white light thrown up by the sun's reflection upon the snow brought tears to his eyes, which he rubbed away with the back of his hand. For the first time since leaving the term, Quentin wondered what the kindly and plump Yorkus, his only friend among the priests, was doing at this moment. Working among his medicines, no doubt, or blistering the ears of some poor acolyte over letters unlearned or scrolls unread. Quentin turned to see Alenia slip out beside him. She was as lovely dressed in the attire of a ranger as in the fine raiment of a queen. Her hair gleamed in the sun, and the cold brought a rosy blush to her fair cheeks.
Do you miss the temple, Quentin?
Alenia regarded him with a warmth and understanding that Quentin had only rarely felt from another person.
In a way, but not so much. I've had but little time to miss anything.
Yes. Yes, there has been little time for aught but escape.
Alenia smiled, and drawing Quentin by the arm, began to walk.
Tell me about what you did in the temple. How did you come to be an acolyte?
I cannot say, my lady. I was very young. My parents were lost to the sleeping plague that swept over the land in the spring of death. I don't remember them or much about my home. I see a face sometimes. Might be my mother's. Mostly, I've always lived in the temple.
Why did you volunteer to leave it then, since you have no other home?
I felt something was pulling me, like I was supposed to go. It was right for me. I've never felt that way about anything before.
It must have been a very strong feeling for you to forsake all that you had known. Your home, your friends.
I have no friends in the temple. Only Bjorkis, one of the elder priests.
Was it lonely for you?
Quentin could not think how to answer her at first.
No. That is, I don't think so. The temple is... The priests exist to serve the god. Acolytes serve the priests. There are rules and tasks. That is all.
The queen nodded thoughtfully. Quentin had not been lonely, because he had known nothing but the rigorous order of the temple, where each had his place and his task.
What would you be doing now if you were there?
Oh, studying. I had much to learn, more than I could master sometimes. And soon, we would begin making ready to receive the god back from his winter journey. He will come in the spring as he always does, and the temple must be ready. Rites of purification must be performed, the sacred stones washed and anointed. Oh, there is much to do.
I believe you.
But then, when everything is ready and the god comes and there is celebration, it goes on for weeks. There are feasts and games and so much happiness. The temple is open to the pilgrims who have gathered outside the walls, and all join in the celebration.
Yes, that is a good time for our people. I have attended some of those celebrations when I was a little girl. I was always afraid of the priests. I thought they were the gods.
Sometimes they think they are too, or they'd like to have you believe it. But I think there must be more to it somehow. I don't know.
I know what you mean. I often think that the gods are not the least bit interested in us or our problems. And sometimes, I think there are no gods at all. And yet, even in my doubting, I feel a presence I cannot explain, a moving within, a longing in my spirit for something more.
You have felt it too. Perhaps that is why I chose to leave. I could no longer stay. Often I would lay awake at night burning with a strange fever. I would hear someone call my name, and yet the night was hushed around me. I used to tell the priests about these things, and they said it was the god calling me, that he had something special for me. But deep inside, I knew that it wasn't it. Finally, Bjorkis told me not to speak about it anymore with any of the other priests. Still, whenever I heard the voice or felt the fire, I would go to Bjorkis, and we would talk about it. He would ask me what I thought it meant.
What do you think it meant?
I'm not a priest. But I do think a god was calling. But a god greater than any other. Higher. Wiser. And he knew me.
You are a special boy. I knew that from the moment I saw you standing nervously in my chamber. I also knew that you were no Tharia.
The gust of wind spun snow around the two figures. Without another word, they turned and went back up the little hill to the cottage. The prince slouched in his winged chair, fingering a soft leather pouch full of gold coins. Sir Bran and Sir Granite stood on either side of him, and all three gazed with some trepidation upon the three visitors in front of them.
I want them found and brought back. This hawk and whoever his friends may be, however it may be accomplished. I care not what means you use.
Sir Bran and Sir Granite, knights hardened in battle and fearless, shrank away from the sight of the harriers. Fierce and brutal men, devoid of human compassion or mercy. The harriers, as they were known in Mensendor, were last descendants of an ancient people in the realm, the cruel Shoth. A savage, war-loving race who killed for the pleasure of killing, and the twisted enjoyment of inflicting pain on another. Over a long and unbroken history of war, the Shoth had developed special powers, which enabled them to pursue their enemies with unerring accuracy. Powers the simple peasants considered supernatural. The ability to see in the dark like cats, to scent a trail, and to hone in on the intense emotions of their prey. It seemed as if they could snatch thoughts out of the air, and so many believed. There were few of the Shoth left in the world. They were dying out stubbornly, but those who lived on employed themselves as mercenary soldiers, or as trackers of outlaws. For either service, they received high rewards from their patrons, as much as ever they desired, since they were not the kind of men one wanted as enemies. The Harriers were greatly feared by everyone who knew of them, or who happened to meet them, upon those rare occasions when one or more might be seen in passing. Two long braids from either side of their heads were woven together and fell down their broad backs. Their features, wolf-like and hard as stone, were made more fearsome by the blue tattooed designs which covered their faces. Their clothing was rough, made of animal skins with the hair scraped or burned off. They wore soft boots made in the same fashion, laced on the outside from ankle to knee. Around their necks, they wore necklaces made from the hair and finger bones of their victims. On their brawny arms were bracelets of human teeth. To see a Harrier was to know fear. Their bizarre appearance was coldly ordained to inspire terror, to immobilize their hapless quarry. They carried long, thin swords with serrated blades, so that a wound from the thrust of a Harrier sword did not heal quickly or without difficulty. That mattered little, since few who ever felt that dangerous edge remained alive to tell it. They also carried small wooden and skin shields on which were painted crude symbols of their barbaric religion, said to include regular human sacrifice. The Harriers who sold their services as trackers also used birds, most often hawks, but also small eagles or ravens, to help them locate their human game at long distance. These birds rode with them upon the Harriers' peculiar, stout, short-legged ponies, upon ornate perches built onto their saddles, usually of bones and hide, again the bones and hide of their victims. Some said the Harriers spoke with their birds mind to mind, so extraordinary was the communication between the two preying creatures.
There are at least three of them. maybe more. I have a report from one of the guards who saw three ride off toward Pelgrin last night.
Prince Jaspin stood abruptly and tossed the bag of coins to the foremost of the harriers, who deftly caught it and slipped it into an inner pouch in his clothing.
There will be more money when you return. You will be paid well. I want them found.
So shall it be done.
And without another word or look, they turned and filed out.
Fair prince, I do not like this turn. I would that you had requested me and some of my men-at-arms to bring back this prisoner for you. These harriers, these barbarians, are not to be trusted. You will get your prisoner and his companions if you care not how many pieces they are in.
I do not care, Bran. I only want them found and stopped.
My lord, why is this man, this hawk, such a menace to you? He is only an outlaw, and even if he were chief among them, he would account you no more loss than your bounty will cost in the end. Why do you seek his end so ardently?
That is my own care, sir, and none of yours. You'll both keep this to yourselves. Do you hear? Besides, it would not do for my new regents to entertain such troublesome pursuits. There are more important things to be done. Come, let us begin making plans for our next little surprise.
Jaspin led them to his table and a pitcher of wine and goblets on a silver tray.
My friends, I pledge your health and continued success.
To Escalon's new king.
The old man lay upon the stone altar in a great darkened hall. Torches smoldered at each corner of the five-sided altar, casting a strange flickering glow which curled and eddied like water over the man's face. He appeared to be asleep or dead. Yet even in the deepest repose, the fierce malevolence of the features did not abate. So bent was the black soul which inhabited that body. It twisted all it touched. The face was a mask of hate, the more terrible because it was also a face of keen intelligence. Nimrud sank, as it seemed to him, through layers of smoke, as if falling from a great height. His head throbbed. Dull pains shot through his limbs, but he willed himself to continue. The smoke thinned and then scattered completely. He looked beneath him and saw the solid earth sliding away below. Still dropping rapidly, but gliding now, not falling, the magician could make out detail in the land. Behind, a high range of snow-capped mountains, the Fiskills. To the right, the long silver ribbon of the Wilst River, now frozen in its wriggling push to the sea. Ahead, but still too dim to see clearly, the dark gray-green mass of the great forest Pelgrin, partially hidden by clouds. Further ahead, but beyond sight, lay Ascalon, the city on a hill. Nimrud slowed his descent, but he felt nothing at all. He closed his eyes, and when he opened them again, he turned his head to see the black wing rising and falling rhythmically as the wind blew shrilly through his feathers. The sorcerer had taken the form of a raven. He flew swiftly on. Approaching Pelgrin, Nimrud's keen raven eyes could see the dim shape of Ascalon rising in the distance. Light was failing as the world sank into the darkness of a long winter night. It would be dark by the time he reached the castle, but it mattered not. Nimrud was a friend of darkness, and of all things that love the darkness. He used the black of night as a cloak to hide his deeds. Nimrud had delved deeply into the hidden arts. He had toyed with secrets veiled from the foundations of the world. He had traveled widely, learning the lore of magicians and sorcerers of every race. An insatiable pupil as a young man, he had studied with every occult master until he was as powerful as any who had lived before him. He had gazed upon the heart of the unspeakable and had bartered every human emotion to gain the power he sought, and which still eluded him, the power to bend all men to his will. When at last he reached his destination, Nimrud circled over Ascalon, descending in sweeping spirals. He dived for the tower where Prince Jaspin's quarters lay and alighted upon the narrow ledge of an arrow loop high in the wall above Jaspin's chamber. Prince Jaspin was alone, sitting in his great chair near the fire. Nimrud fluttered to the floor, changing back into his human form as he lightly touched down.
Ah, Prince Jaspin.
You are not expecting anyone, are you?
By Zor! You startled me. No, by Asriel, I should say not. No one. Least of all you, Nimrud. How did you get here?
That would not interest you very much, I'm afraid. After all, I'm not really here at all. You see merely a phantasm. My projected soul body, or what you will.
The sorcerer crossed the room, and as he passed in front of the fire, Jaspin could see the flames shining faintly through his ghostly form. He came to stand directly in front of the astonished prince.
What are you doing here? If you will not tell me how you got here, you'll tell me why, I'll warrant.
Indeed I shall.
The wizard folded his arms upon his breast and glared down upon Prince Jaspin.
You let him escape!
He had help! Friends within the castle! I have had the keeper of the dungeon and the guards beheaded.
Silence! Don't you think spilling the blood of worthless guards will appease me? Will it bring back the prize?
Nimrud frowned furiously. Jaspin watched in dread fascination.
He is mine! I want him! Twice you have let him escape!
Twice? Surely you are mistaken. We have only caught him once.
Nimrud, mistaken? You little know me, Prince Jekyll. You fool! Do you not know? This outlaw, Hawk, is none other than Lord Thedo of Crandall, the greatest military mind of his age. None other. You had him in your clutches when you arrested him upon his return from the wars. You let him slip away then, too.
Oh, that was different!
You raise your voice against Nimrud!
The fire in the hearth billowed forth, spilling a torrent of cinders and sparks into the room. Jaspin felt the heat on his face.
I shall reduce this pile of stone to smoldering ashes, my prince! Be careful!
Ran his long, slender hands through his wild hair.
What do you intend to do about it?
I have set Harriers upon the trail. We shall have him back before too many days have passed.
All right. I see you can use your head when you're pressed to it. But notify me at once when you have him once more. Dead or alive, I want him. You have brought yourself another chance, and maybe saved your crown. But do not fail this time, or it will be your last human act.
Nimrud then turned and fixed Prince Jaspin with a terrifying scowl. Jaspin felt his limbs grow heavy, losing strength. His heart turned cold within his breast.
Oh, there are worse fates than death, I assure you. I know several, all equally distressing. I reserve them for those who particularly disappoint me. You have one more chance. Do not disappoint me.
The sorcerer turned and stepped into the flaming fireplace. The heat brought Jaspin to his feet. The wizard appeared to stretch, growing taller and more transparent.
Do you know that Ronson lives? No? Well, not for long. I have sent my men to capture him.
Jaspin sank once more into the winged chair. His face had taken on the pallor of a dead man. The fire on Derwin's hearth had burned low. Quentin slept lightly, curled in a warm corner near the fire. He felt as if he had finally saturated himself with slumber. His mind drifted hazily through shifting dreams. It had been an uneventful day, spent in talk and minute preparations, of which Quentin had but a small part. He had mostly eaten and slept, and cared for the horses, making sure they all had an extra portion in payment for their hard ride the night before. Thedo and Derwin sat near the fire, smoking long wooden pipes filled with aromatic leaves which Derwin had cultivated. They sat in silence, all talked out. Alenia slept comfortably, stretched upon Derwin's low wooden bed. She had said little all day, but Quentin thought her eyes spoke eloquently of the turmoil taking place within. They seemed to weep inside for the anguish she felt for her king. Still, she had put aside her own torment and had found kind words to say to Quentin in that moment when they were together. For that, Quentin had declared to himself, he would gladly give his life for hers at the first opportunity. Derwin rose at last. He knocked his pipe gently against the stone mantel and turned to roll himself in his cloak in some further corner, leaving Thedo to his thoughts.
What?
Derwin had stopped where he stood, listening. Thedo, his chair tilted back, resting his long legs against the fireplace, stopped puffing and listened too. This time, the whistle was closer. Thedo got up and went to the door and slipped out. A cold draft washed over Quentin, rousing him more fully awake. Thedo, replying to the signal. Alenia was awake now and standing near Derwin.
Voss and his bushmen have a visitor for us. They're bringing him along.
There stood the squat leader of the Rangers. Behind him was another man held in tow by several of Voss's companions.
Come in, Voss. Let us see your catch.
The hefty ranger strode into the cabin and waved his charge forward.
Tren!
Tren swayed uncertainly upon his feet and looked about to topple over, but Voss put a hand out to steady him. Derwin whisked up a stool and sat the man down.
We watched him as soon as he entered the wood. When he appeared to be heading in this direction, we took him.
Tren, what are you doing here? Has Jasmine discovered our game?
As I fear, my lady. I came to warn you all. Jasmine has put harriers on your trail. I pray to every god I knew that I would not come too late.
At the mention of the dreaded trackers, even Voss's broad face blanched.
This is dire news.
Alenia's hand went to her face. She shot a hasty look to Thedo, who stood unmoved.
There is our answer.
Thedo ignored Derwin, turning his gaze to Tren.
How long ago did this take place?
I saw them enter the postern gate this morning about midday, conducted by several of Jaspin's knights. There was also much activity through the main gate this morning. Knights and nobles, some from as far away as the Flatlands. Rumor has it that Jasmine has called a hasty council to catch those that helped you escape.
What? The man is mad.
Oh, that was just a ruse. Prince Jasmine accused two nobles of lending aid to your escape. I got it from the jailer, the new jailer, that two nobles were being held, Lords Weldon and Larkut.
Oh, the snake! He's using my escape to alter the Council of Regents. I suppose he wasted no time in having two new regents enfranchised. Do you know who took the others' places?
I cannot say positively, but I think Sir Bran and Sir Grenet. It was said that Lord Holborn stood up to him, saved the lives of the lords. The prince wanted them bound over for treason. Lord Holborn appealed to the king's law.
He saved their lives for the time being, and probably lost his own.
Does Jasmine dare so much? I had no idea.
We cannot help Weldon and Larkot. We must help ourselves now. Tren, how did you get here without the harriers seeing you?
I left before they did, and I knew where they was going. Had little trouble making good time, though I must have nearly killed my good horse.
They will have followed you. It'll make their task so much the easier.
I hope I have more wits about me than that. I had some of my men ride out with me to muddle the trail. They rode with me away, and then each split off in a different direction. It was all I could do in the time I had.
Good. That will buy us some time.
My comrades and I can purchase some more. I will put them to work at once confounding the trail. We can lead the fiends through the forest for days.
These are harriers, not ordinary hunters.
And we are not ordinary game. Don't worry. They will never see us nor learn our trick until you are well on your way. But we won't be able to stop them forever.
We could fight them.
And die trying. No, our only hope is to stay ahead of them until we cross the wall. I doubt if even harriers can find us once we've crossed over into the Wilderlands.
So it is. You admit it now. We are going to Dekra.
Yes, we're going to Dekra. You have your way, my friend. And it is our only hope. We go to Dekra, and we leave tonight.
From Derwin's cottage in the heart of Pelgrim Forest, under Night's Dark Wing, the unlikely rescue party set forth on their quest. They little dared hope for the success of their labors, nor scarce conceived a plan by which they might obtain their goal of freeing the king from the malignant magician Nimrud. In a fortnight upon the trail, heading north and east through the furthest reaches of Pelgrin and the low foothills of the Fiskills, they'd encounter no other living soul. This, however, was accounted as an auspicious tiding, for it meant that they had not seen what they feared most to see, and that which kept them all peering over their shoulders when they thought no one else was watching, they had not seen a trace of the merciless harriers. Led by Durwin and urged on by Fado, they pursued a course that would skirt the treacherous mountains and lead them instead across the hilly woodland regions of Ascalon, bending ever eastward toward Silvercourt's wall. Once over the wall, traversing that formidable obstacle would be an ordeal all its own. The rescuers would make straight for the Malmar Inlet, crossing it on foot over the ice. Safely across Malmar, they would have a brief rest in the small fishing village of Malmarby, one of the few outposts of human habitation in all of the vast peninsula of Obrey. They would have time, it was hoped, to replenish their supplies and to obtain a guide who could be induced to lead them to Dekra. Quentin had at last learned that Dekra was not a person but a place, the forgotten city of a mysterious people long ago vanished. No one now remembered what had happened to the city's strange inhabitants, but they had left behind a fantastic dwelling, which had grown rich and wonderful in song and legend, although few men had actually ever been there to see it. Fewer still believed its existence, regarding it as mere glittering fancy spun by bards and minstrels to tickle the ears of the gullible. Some, though, insisted that it did exist, and was a very evil place where men were not welcome. Those daring to search for it never returned, so it was told.
Never heard of Dekra, my boy?
Derwin's bushy eyebrows arched in a quizzical look when Quentin ventured to ask him about it.
No, I don't suppose you have. The priests of Ariel do not willingly admit that it exists. Well, you shall have a chance to do something most men never do. You shall see it with your own eyes.
Is it a very bad place, then? Is that why Fado wished not to go there?
Quentin was riding Balder abreast of the hermit, having left his usual position at the rear of the train just ahead of Tren. Quentin liked to ride up ahead with Durwin, whenever the trail permitted.
No, Dekra is not an evil place, though many believe that it is. It is one of the seven ancient places of power on the Earth. And though the power is mostly gone now, remnants still linger for those who know where to look. But it is not an evil place. That is not why Thedo argued against our going. He knew it would be a dangerous journey and a long one for nothing if we should fail to obtain what we seek.
Quentin had had to content himself with that answer, for Durwin would say no more about the ruined city or their reason for going there. Yet the hermit was withholding more than he would say. Quentin sensed it in his voice. Something there Durwin avoided telling, and Quentin itched to find out what it was. So he listened constantly for any clue which Durwin or Thedo might let fall at mealtimes or around the fire at night. He was most often disappointed. Thedo spurred the party forward at a relentless pace, never stopping long or allowing a fire by daylight. Nights were short by design, stopping at dusk, sleeping only a few hours, and then moving on well before dawn. Quentin had mastered the art of sleeping in his saddle when he could no longer keep his eyes open. In fact, he had found himself rapidly becoming a better horseman all around. He reveled in the new skills he was developing day by day, and the woodland lore he was learning from Durwin, who proved an inexhaustible source of knowledge. Quentin could now name 30 different kinds of tree and shrub. He could tell the tracks of every forest creature that stirred in the dead of winter, and he could read the weather signs with some small degree of accuracy. Quentin considered this far more useful information than anything he had learned in the temple, although he had to admit his temple training was useful in other ways. For these and other reasons, arising mainly out of the kinship formed of a group dedicated to a common purpose, Quentin felt a deep sense of joy in the rigors of the journey, forgetting easily the innumerable discomforts of living on the trail. He had also quite nearly forgotten the danger dogging their every step, the harriers. Yet there seemed to be nothing to indicate the presence of the hated trackers. Thedo, however, continually dropped behind the group, leaving it for hours at a time to watch and wait, scanning the forest for any sign which might indicate that they were being followed. Each time he returned to report that he had seen nothing of the harriers, but each day he grew more worried.
I am afraid they're waiting for us to run out into the open.
Thedo spoke to the group one night. The sun had just gone down, and they sat around the fire wrapped in their cloaks and thick robes made of animal skins, which Derwin had furnished.
You don't think we might have eluded him? That Voss and his rangers put him off the trail?
No, I fear not. Voss may have put them off for some short time, and by the fact that we are still awake and moving, I'd say that was likely. But each day I feel their presence stronger. I seem to sense the fingers of their minds reaching out for us, drawing closer. They may not have found our trail as yet, but they are closing upon us.
Why do you think they would wait for us to break and run into the open? Why would they not take us in the forest?
That I do not know. There is something preventing them, though what it is I cannot say. But once we are free of the forest, which we shall be in 2 days' time, they will have no trouble seeing us. The hills beyond offer little cover in the summer, and less in the winter, for those who need shelter from praying eyes.
Yet if we can but cross the hill country as far as the Great Wall, we will then have a chance.
Derwin alone looked hopeful.
We still have to find a way to cross the wall. That could take many days. Unless my horse sprouts wings, I do not see how we are to cross.
There must be a way. The wall is old, perchance there is a breach.
Pray there is no breach, my lady. Any advantage we receive, our captors will benefit the more.
The harriers are not our captors.
The others stopped and looked at Quentin, raising their heads from the fire to see his face. He wore an expression of fear and wonder, his dark round eyes looking beyond the circle of light thrown out by the campfire.
These men are.
Thedo was the first to follow Quentin's gaze outward and to see what he saw. A ring of faces, almost invisible in the darkness but for the firelight glinting in large eyes, circled them in. They were surrounded. The Jair village, if that word could be applied so loosely, was as nearly invisible as could be made. Shelters for 50 or more people had been erected out of limbs and branches, barks and leaves. Each was dug into the earth and was shaped like a shallow dome. If there had been no people standing in front of these simple abodes or peering from the narrow slits of doorways, Quentin could have passed right through the rude village and never had an inkling he had been there. The footprints in the snow on the ground told a different story. The snow had been compacted by the constant trampling of many feet. It appeared that the Jair had been living in this part of the forest all winter, as indeed they had. Hunting and trapping in the northernmost reaches of Pelgrim, they'd established a winter camp in the forest. They would move again in the spring when they returned to their usual habitat, the wilderlands of Obrey. Seeing them now in the full light of day, Quentin wondered what he had feared from them in the long night when they had stood at the edge of the campfire's light. All night they had held their strange vigil, faces shifting only slightly as one would go and another appear to take his place. Quentin had imagined all sorts of horrible tortures at their hands, but looking now at their broad brown faces, their finely formed yet sturdy features, or their clear, untroubled brown eyes, which seemed wise and all-knowing, Quentin was ashamed he had thought ill of these simple folk. When the dawn had come, the leader, who called himself Hoar, had advanced to the campfire where Thedo and Derwin stood waiting to receive them in whatever manner they presented themselves, in war or in peace. Then, quite inexplicably, Derwin had startled everyone, not the least the Jair tribesmen, by speaking a few halting words in their lilting sing-song tongue. Derwin had turned to the others then and addressed them sheepishly.
I'm sorry, my friends. I should have told you all sooner that we had nothing to fear from the Jair. But I thought it best to remain on our guard, for it has been long since I encountered any of them about in this part of the forest, and many changes have taken place in the world. I could not be certain what reception we faced, but it is as I hoped. They welcome us as friends.
At wonder it was. The Jair were a wandering people. Simple, uncomplicated, their ways had not changed much in 1,000 years. They built no cities, erected no altars, neither read nor wrote their own language. They were older even than the hated Shoth, older than the land, for all anyone knew. Where they had come from was a mystery long past discovering, one of the many which, like bark grown thick around an ancient oak, surrounded these shy people. They were seldom seen in the region of Ascalon anymore. Civilization forced them further and further north and east into the wilderlands. Few city dwellers ever encountered the gentle Jair, but the peasants living close to the northern edges of Pelgrin glimpsed them on rare occasions. Sometimes they would not be seen in a region for a generation or more, and then suddenly appear just as before. The Jair were a peaceful, timid people who had no enemies, except the brutal Shoth, whom they hunted like the deer they lived upon. It was a marvel that these unassuming beings could fight at all. They did not seem capable of conflict. But they had among their surprising traits an inbred hatred for the last of their ancient enemy. Durwin sat in consultation with Hoar, the Jair chieftain, in the midst of the small clearing. Quentin could tell the going was very slow. The same words were repeated over and over, with many gestures and lapses into confused silence. But Durwin seemed to be making headway. He nodded more frequently and seemed to ask questions less often. All this Quentin wildly inferred, since nothing in the Jair speech seemed like words in the ordinary sense. And yet to Quentin's ears it was strangely beautiful and even moving, for in it he heard the gentle sounds of the earth as it moved through the seasons, of trees in the wind, of water slapping stone, of animals playing. The language of the Jair was filled with the beauty of the forest and its creatures. While the two leaders tried to understand one another, Quentin established contact in his own way, gawking unashamedly at the strange people who had gathered around them. The Jair just as boldly stared back, pointing at the outlanders, their term for anyone who was not another Jair, and coveting their horses and steel knives. The Jair, Quentin decided, were a compact race, tending more toward grace than bulk. They possessed smooth, well-formed bodies, lithe rather than muscular, again, like deer. The Jair had so long lived with the deer that he'd become like them. It struck Quentin that they even looked like deer, with their large, dark, fathomless eyes, deep as forest pools and as calm. They wore deerskin clothing, sewn of deer gut thread with deer bone needles. They ate venison, burned deer fat in their lamps, made from skulls of deer. The race had become wholly dependent upon the deer for survival, and followed them wherever the nimble animals went, running with them through the seasons. On any of the crudely decorated items of clothing or personal possessions Quentin happened to see were usually pictures of deer, painted, scratched, or carved into the item, or perhaps a representation of the sun, which they also revered. And the people had the same quick instincts and lightning reactions as the shy forest creatures. That, coupled with their acute awareness of their surroundings, made them invisible to the loud, clumsy white races who tramped through the forest, unaware that there might be other living souls as close as the larch they passed under. Quentin was engaged in making hand signals with several of the braver Jair children who had gathered around, when Durwin rose and shuffled back to where the rest were seated on deerskins in the snow, awaiting the outcome of the parley.
Hoar says that we are marked for death.
Durwin quickly realized his blunder by the stricken looks of anguish appearing on his comrades' faces.
Oh, no, not by the Jair. Oh, my, no. Forgive me. I have been trying to piece together the story and did not realize what I was saying. Hoar says that we are being followed by harriers, which we know. However, the harriers were closer than we had guessed. Last night should have been our last. He said that was the reason they stayed with us through the night, watching, lest the Shoth try to take us. Without our knowing, we have stumbled very close to their winter village, and they did not want any Shoth coming so close to them.
So they protected us through the night, did they? I am grateful for their aid. But what will happen when we leave here? The harriers will be waiting for us soon as we enter the forest.
We have discussed that.
Durwin smiled and inclined his head toward Hoar, who stood a few paces away. Hoar repeated the gesture.
Hoar says he will give us a bodyguard and a guide to lead us away from the Shoth by ways known to them.
How many men will go with us?
Trin's eyes scanned the group for likely conscripts.
5 or 6 of the bigger men should be adequate, I think.
In his soldier's brain, Trin had already formed them into a fighting contingent and outfitted them with the helmets, bucklers, and hard leather armor of foot soldiers.
I cannot say how many Hoar intends to send with us.
Durwin turned and went back to where the chief was standing, arms folded, chin resting on his breast. They put their heads together and began discussing again, hands groping as if to pull words out of the air. Finally, Hoar turned and waved his hands toward a group of men who were standing by the horses, admiring the animals, tack, and gear. A slender young man, not much older than Quentin, came gliding over and presented himself to Hoar, who presented him to Derwin. Derwin returned with the youth.
Here is our bodyguard and guide.
What?
Trent's eyes started out of his head, and his mouth hung open. The young Jair did not seem a fair match even for one of his own people, let alone three bloodlusting harriers.
This is Toli.
When do we leave?
Thedo, too, had his doubts about the Jair bodyguard. He cast a quick glance overhead to see the once clear sky had become overcast while they had waited for Derwin and Hoare's deliberations to run their course.
Hoare suggests we sleep for a few hours. We can leave tonight. He also says not to worry. Toli will show us a secret way past the wall, which he claims the Shoth do not know.
The king sat in darkness in the deep dungeon of Kazakh, Nimrud's walled mountain keep. Around him lay the scattered pieces of his armor, now rusting in the dank jail's seeping dump. The king's once proud head fell forward dejectedly upon his chest, and his sunken eyes were closed against the disgrace of his surroundings. His long black hair and well-kept beard, once curling with vitality, now hung in limp tangles, filthy and matted, graying at the edges. Inwardly, he cursed himself for his own stupidity and lack of foresight. So intent had he been upon returning home, so full of good spirits, he had dismissed his men to his commanders, and taking only a small bodyguard of knights, had set off straightaway to catch the last boat before the raging seas of fall brought an end to the shipping season. They had boarded the ship, and had with some misgiving of the captain, sailed forth upon a sea running to chop, and a sky glowering with pent-up fury. The storm had broken the fourth day out, and the captain had made for the nearest port, the harbor Fallers, at the far southern tip of Elsinore. The captain had wisely refused to go further, so Escavar and his knights struck out cross-country. A day and a night out, they were attacked. A force of armed men had been waiting to take them as they entered the narrow canyon. The king and his knights fought valiantly, though greatly outnumbered, but at last had been overpowered. They were bound and thrown into wagons and covered with sailcloth, and traveled for many days through rocky country. One of the knights, Ronsard, had been able to work free of his bonds and had escaped, recovering his horse and weapons, but having to leave behind his king and comrades. Ronsard had followed the wagons to their destination, a ship with black sails standing off a lonely stretch of coastland. He had followed, hoping to seize an opportunity to free his companions. But when he espied the dark ship and its stout occupants, he despaired of loosing his friends with his lone sword and had turned toward Mensendor with his message for the queen. The months had passed, each day more unbearable than the one before it. King Escavar refused to surrender to the hopelessness he felt closing around him.
Damn you, sorcerer! You will set me free! I said, set me free!
At first, he had railed against his captor, his mighty voice kindled in righteous rage. The halls and galleries of Kazakh reverberated with his angry thunder. Nimrud had paced his chambers, his wild eyes kindled with a fierce, unearthly light. After weeks of captivity, Nimrud had descended to his dungeon to at last cast his wicked eyes upon his prize. The king had challenged him, had begged for the freedom of his knights, had promised a stunning ransom, had demanded to know the reasons for his kidnapping. To this latter demand, he had been told that his brother, Prince Jaspin, had arranged to have him kept comfortably and safely locked away until Jaspin wore the crown. Nimrud had left then, leaving his miserable prisoner alone to eat out his great heart in anger and frustration. The king had seen no other living person since that brief interview.
Jailer comes with food.
Then Escavar saw the flickering light of a torch playing on the rough rock walls of the narrow gallery that led along the row of cells. From the shuffle he heard in the gallery, he guessed there were more than the jailer alone. A torch thrust into sight, blinding his clouded eyes with its unwanted brightness. Escobar struggled to his feet uncertainly, to tower over the jailer and his two scurvy guards.
You get back there!
The jailer thrust the torch through the bars of the iron door. The old rusty door swung open, and the two guards, with lances at the ready, stepped gingerly in. One prodded the king forward with the butt of his lance, and the king tottered like an old man into the gallery. The dripping passageway was so narrow and short, he had to hunch himself together, bending low to proceed. For good measure, and to remind the prisoner that he was under guard, the spearmen would jab him in the back periodically as they made their way to the spiral steps. Escobar stumbled twice as they climbed the steps, but caught himself and continued the climb slowly and with great deliberation. He was buying himself time to restore some part of his strength and allow his eyes to become accustomed to the pale light, which grew brighter as they ascended upward out of the dungeon. At last, the king stepped out into fair light again. It seemed to dazzle his deprived senses. He found his head cleared from the confusion he had fallen into of late. He straightened with difficulty and squared his shoulders and raised his head high. The party was ushered into the great hall where Nimrud sat waiting on his high black throne.
So, our prisoner lives still, does he? Too bad. Our pets will have to wait a little yet for their meat.
Escobar noticed the huge, ugly head of a tremendous snake leering at him from beneath the throne.
Set me free or kill me. You shall receive no ransom, and my brother will never sit upon my throne. The regents will never allow it.
But several of your regents seem to have come under suspicion of certain foul deeds. Two of them are even now locked away in the bowels of Castle Ascalon, awaiting their impending fate.
You fiend!
The king dashed forward. One of the guards sought to block his path with lowered lance. But the king grabbed the lance and wrenched it out of the man's grasp and shoved him back with the butt of his own weapon. The king swung the lance in a wide arc around himself, keeping the jailer and the other guard at a distance. Escobar lowered the lance and advanced on Nimrud menacingly. The sorcerer raised his arms above his head. Something like a leaden net dropped upon the king's limbs, and he felt his strength leave him. He raised his mighty arm to loft the lance, but the weapon suddenly seemed to weigh as much as the dungeon door. The throw went soft, and the lance skidded weakly upon the stone floor.
You shall see what my powers can do! I have been waiting for just this moment. Find him and take him to the tower!
Kill me now! You missed this chance, you will regret it for all eternity, Black Wizard!
The guards rushed upon the helpless monarch and bound him in chains. They dragged him out of the hall and to the tower, where he was locked again in a strange room. Not a cell, but a high domed room painted with grotesque shapes and queer inscriptions. No sooner had he entered the room and the door slammed behind him, did King Escobar feel himself overcome with an unnatural urge to sleep. The heavy vapors of slumber seemed to drift out of the very floor beneath his feet. His head nodded and lolled on his shoulders, his eyelids fluttering. His knees buckled, and he crashed to the wooden floor, where he attempted to rise again. The king gained his knees and knelt awkwardly, for his chains would permit but limited movement.
You will find this rest here refreshing, I hope.
Escobar jerked his head up to see the sharp, twisted face of his tormentor at the barred slits of the door.
I curse your bones, necromancer!
But even as he spoke, Escobar's tongue went slack in his mouth, and his eyelids fell shut. He tried again to rise, but his legs could not support him. He dropped senseless to his side, fast asleep.
Look your last upon the world as a mortal, great king. It is a rare gift I give you. When you awaken, you will be one of my own immortals. Sleep well.
In the 4 days since they had left the camp of the nomadic Jair, Derwin's party had covered ground at a tremendous rate. They were all amazed at the skill and clear thinking of their guide, Toli, none so much as Tren, who had severely doubted that they would last an hour more in the forest. But Toli knew the land like his own skin. He knew instinctively when a trail would veer and when to abandon one path and choose another. The forest seemed to hide no secrets from his alert eyes. In fact, this slim brown young man read it as easily as Derwin read the scrolls he collected in such profusion. Quentin suspected that generations of following the deer had made the Jair more at home in the forest among the wild things than in the world of men. In this, he shared the conventional wisdom, for the wary Jair were widely considered a people sinking back into animal ways rather than arising out of them. But a better guide they could not have found anywhere. And if there had been six like him, the company could not have been safer from discovery by the harriers. Toli knew when to halt and when to move forward. He varied the times of their travel, never keeping to a determined pattern, but moving more like a cunning animal might, though still chiefly at night. Still, none of them doubted that the harriers were yet behind them. Toli agreed that until they crossed the wall, there would be no safety. He and Derwin were often in consultation shortly before and after each day's trek. Derwin began to grow visibly more apprehensive as they neared the great structure. The ancient architectural wonder had protected the realm of Metzendor for 1,000 years from marauders and would-be conquerors. Now it stood as a warning of the strength and determination of the people of Metzendor to live free, for no enemy had dared to cross it with an army in anyone's memory. Silbercore's Wall, as it was known of old, rose to a height of 40 spans from the rocky, uneven ground to the jagged merlins which formed its battlements. The wall was wide enough at the top for 3 knights to ride abreast, or a column of men to move along with ease. It spanned a gray, barren stretch of land, 100 leagues in length, from the inlet of Malmar to the sheer rock curtain of Mount Ostenkel in the northernmost Fiskills. Selbercore's Wall was intended to separate Ascalon from the entire Wilderland region of the Suthlands, but it had never been finished. Only the northern extremity running south from Malmar's icy finger to the treacherous Fiskills had been erected, and that at a dear cost. But it stood intact, a staggering achievement, seamless, without gap or breach imposed by the years, raised with such stonecutter's art that no mortar was used, only stone fitted to stone, interlocked and assembled with exacting precision throughout its whole length.
Tonight we will cross the wall, and most assuredly tonight the harriers will try to stop us. Toli thinks they are not far behind, and they probably already sense what we are going to attempt. We will be vulnerable once we leave the shelter of the forest. The forest will end about a league before the wall, but there is a valley which runs along our course. We shall enter it and follow as long as we may.
What then?
What then? Why, Toli will lead us to the Jair's secret crossing. If we make it, I doubt if the Shoth will pursue us farther. It would take them weeks to find a means to cross the wall with their horses, and months to ride around it.
How will we get our horses across?
Yes, are we to take our horses or not?
Toli does not know. The Jair do not have horses, so have never considered whether it is possible to bring them through. You see, the secret way is not over the wall, but under it. A tunnel.
Blazes!
Tran liked the scheme less and less.
Is it so bad to continue without horses?
It would be very difficult.
Impossible.
Not impossible. Remember, Toli and his people live in the Wilderlands. He will show us how to get through them. They travel the land continually.
The main thing is the loss of our horses will slow us down considerably. Dekra is still weeks away, longer on foot.
Quentin listened to this talk with a sorrowful feeling. He hated the thought of leaving Balder behind to become the prey of the wolves, or worse, the harriers. He turned away and went to the animal he had grown quite attached to in the short time they had been together.
They say you may be left behind, Balder. I would rather they left me behind. I don't want to leave you.
Quentin put an arm around the huge animal's neck and pressed his cheek into the horse's thick shoulder. Balder swung his head down to nip Quentin on the arm.
You are fond of this animal.
Quentin turned to see Thedo standing near him, reaching up to pat Balder's white forehead.
I did not realize it till just now.
It is nothing to be ashamed of.
A knight must have a thought for his mount. In battle, you are partners. And this sturdy warhorse knows best how to protect his rider in a fight, I'll warrant.
He'll be able to fend for himself, won't he? When we turn them loose?
Yes, he will manage. Better than we will, I should think. But I have no intention of turning them loose if it can be helped. We need our horses too desperately.
Quentin saw the look of strain in the tight lines around his friend's eyes.
Is it that difficult, this road through the Wilderlands?
Quentin had not considered that it would be very much different than what they had experienced in the forest.
Yes, worse than you can imagine if you have not seen it. There is no road, nor path, nor even trail. The whole region is naught but thickets of brush and bramble resting on a queasy bog. At least we shall have the benefit of snow to firm our footing. But even with that, we must be careful. Many of the bogs are fed by warm springs underground. They do not freeze in winter, though the snow will sometimes cover them over. There are few more hazardous places for a company of travelers.
Quentin took this news glumly and wished the journey was at an end. He was beginning to tire of the constant making and breaking of camp and the long, cold intervals between. He had long ago stopped thinking about the Harriers and the terrors they held. After days of fretting constantly and lying awake through the night clutching his dagger, he had simply refused to consider them anymore. Now he was once again forced to wonder what they might do to him if he were caught. The party once more set out. The forest thinned around them as they pushed ever nearer the wall, and so too did the awful dread increase. What lay behind them was not to be dwelt upon for any length of time. Quentin felt only partly more secure. For this run to the wall, Tolly had been mounted with him on Balder, the largest of the horses. The two sat together comfortably, Tolly occupying the place behind Quentin. Although the Jera had no horses of their own, they seemed to be unafraid of them, and tolerably able to handle them when given the chance. But Quentin, being the better horseman of the two, held the reins, and Tolly directed the course. The group traveled a league and more, single file behind Balder's lead. The sky was dark overhead, moon and stars obscured by low-scudding clouds. So much the better. Maybe the Harriers would not see them at all. Finally, they reached the edge of the forest, and without hesitation, Tolly led them out onto a wide expanse of barren hills, where standing stones lurched out of the ground sharply and at odd angles. The landscape was a desolate waste, the exposed roots of the subterranean rock shelf that pushed up inland to form the Fiskills. To Quentin, it appeared a lonely, forsaken place, bare and forbidding. Picking up the pace, Tolly led them down a steep incline to the bottom of a broad gully, which had been formed by the icy waters of spring cutting through the loose soil. Above them on either side rose the banks of this dry stream bed. Long icicles hung down from the lips of overhanging rock, and the slight wind which had risen behind them whispered over the craggy fissures. Ahead or behind, they could see nothing. Overhead, only the blank dark sky. But each of them began to sense a deep foreboding, almost a loathing to continue. Each step became a labor, and each turn in the way a thing to be avoided. In spite of Tolly's urgings, the party slowed and began feeling its way along haltingly. Quentin felt the fear wash over him and knew that it did not come from within. He had, as an acolyte, witnessed possession rituals where a priest would call upon the god to inhabit his body for a brief time to espouse the god's oracles. He had felt the same sensation on those occasions when the supercharged emotional atmosphere gave vent to the strange proceedings. This impending force Quentin knew was foreign, and with a jolt realized its source, the Harriers. They were coming at last. In the same instant Quentin framed the thought, he felt an icy tingle skitter along his ribs, and he swiveled in the saddle to peer behind him. He saw nothing. Then, even as he turned to look away, he caught a glimpse of a dark shape melting into the background some distance away. What it was could not be seen, but Quentin knew in his heart that the Harriers were upon them. He jerked the rein sharply. Balder stopped dead, and Fado nearly collided with him as his animal lurched forward in the dark.
I saw something behind us just now.
Quentin saw Fado's face only as a dark mask in the darkness around it.
How far back?
I cannot tell. I only saw something move back there. Listen!
It was the sound of a stone falling into the ravine, somewhere far behind them.
Away!
serpent and slapped Balder and let the animal have his head. Through the twisting gorge they rode, Tolly holding on to Quentin with a stubborn grip. Quentin looked forward to see the banks on either side sloping away as they began to climb a shallow incline. A final burst, and they were out of the valley. Rising in front of them was the massive, undulating shape of Selbercor's wall, a looming rampart of astonishing dimensions. Quentin urged the horse forward as overhead the moon broke through the low overcast. Now he could see the vast bulwark of the wall towering above them, although they were still some distance from the foot of it. The moon disappeared again as they turned and began running along the face of the wall at an angle toward it. They galloped down another steep ravine and started up the opposite side. They had just gained the top of the further bank when the moon again peeped out, scattering light across the wild landscape. To Quentin's horror, he saw in that fleeting stream the glint of steel and two riders wheeling toward him. Tully tugged at Quentin's arm, and he threw the reins to the side and headed straight for the wall. Quentin thought it was a woman's scream, and then recognized it as the hunting cry of a hawk. A rider bolted past him.
To the wall! Lead the others to the wall!
Quentin saw the moonlight shimmer on the thin line of Fado's uplifted blade. Tully waved his arm for the others to follow as they started upon the wall.
They're upon us!
Trent's horse stumbled on the loose rock, and he went down. The queen just ahead of him turned and started back.
My queen, no! I shall look to him! Go on!
The queen's quick horse flew over the uncertain footing as nimbly as a shadow, and in an instant, she was beside Quentin and Tully. Just ahead, but hidden from them by an outcropping of rock, Quentin could hear the sounds of battle. They reached a sheltered hollow, and Tully threw himself to the ground and ran directly up to the very face of the wall. Quentin blinked his eyes. From the shifting moonlight, he thought he had seen the young Jared disappear right into the huge foundation stones of Selbercor's wall. But he was back almost at once, pushing them forward.
Follow! Follow!
This time, the hawk's cry was very close. Quentin spun around, instinctively throwing an arm over his face, as Tully, leaping like a cat, caught his other arm and pulled him to the ground. Quentin felt a sharp pain, high up in the arm he'd thrown over his head. He saw Derwin come pounding in, and Tran hanging sideways over the back of his horse, slumped to the ground. Quentin rolled his eyes and saw two white wings lifting away in the night. He looked at his arm and saw that his tunic had been ripped and blood was oozing out of the wound.
Here's the tunnel!
Quentin felt hands lift him to his feet, and then he was running for the wall. Quentin suddenly thought it strange that he should be running like a scared deer. He wanted to sit down. The air around him became warm. He slowed and turned. Quentin cocked his head, puzzled, for Fado had begun speaking in an unknown language. Quentin stopped and looked up at the twin moons hovering just overhead. He reached up to touch one, as if to pluck it and hold it in his hand. He heard the ringing of temple bells far away. Then the black sky turned blood red. Quentin blinked his eyes and sat down, marveling at this queer wonder. He felt his head slam down against the smooth stone of the wall, and the last thing he saw was Derwin's face peering down upon him, as if from a great height. A tear rolled down Quentin's cheek, and he knew no more.